Steve, we know that the Rockford Symphony season is basically comprised of two different series, the classics and the pops. And I think we have some idea of the difference between the two, but would you shed some more light on this difference?
Well, one is classic and one is pops. When I started here, there were no pops concerts in 1991. And our first pops concert was the Holiday Pops concert. And then we added them one after that and another after that. Now we're doing a total of four. And, you know, why do we do pops concerts? Because people like them. Yeah. They really do. We don't do pops concerts because we want to, you know, this is a way of sneaking people into the theater and now they're going to buy a classic subscription. Well, that would be nice, and occasionally that happens. But it's a different style of music, a different type of music. And if you were at the concert on last Saturday night, the Behind the Mask Broadway concert, you get to hear something that you don't get to hear anywhere anymore in any theater in the whole world, and that is some of those great Broadway shows with accompanied by a full orchestra. Now it's a synthesizer or two or three or four and maybe a string player and maybe a percussionist, and that's it. They've gotten real cheap in hiring pit orchestras. So you get to hear the full glory of this great music with the full symphony orchestra in back of it. I know a lot of conductors don't like to conduct pops concerts. They think it's kind of beneath them or something. I love them. I think they're just so much fun. One of my unfulfilled goals in life, or well, it's not really a goal, it's never going to happen, but if I could be a jazz pianist, really, really what I would love to do. Well, forget it. It's not going to happen. But for one night, to be able to dive into that milieu and to do those great tunes, the Broadway tunes, the old Rat Pack tunes, and all of this stuff, and not to mention the movies we're doing now, the accompanying the great music. We started out with the Wizard of Oz, and we did Jurassic Park last year and Beauty of the Beast this year. You know, those were really, you know, high points in my life when I think about it. You know, who gets to conduct Judy Garland? that was just so much fun. It also took a year or two off of my life. It was one of the hardest things I ever did in my life. But there's a place for both these both concerts, and we're just really happy we can do both.
There is a program that comes up before any of the others in the next season, the 1920 season, and that is the Star Spangled Spectacular on July 3rd at the Starlight Theater. And that is one of my personal favorites. It's so patriotic and triumphant, and it is particularly a favorite because it gives me hope that there will actually be warm weather on the horizon. But what can we look forward to at that concert this summer?
Well, there are going to be some things that are going to be on that concert. You know, the veteran salute where everybody gets to stand up and when they hear their service song being played, that's always going to be there. There is always going to be the 1812 overture because you've got to have the fireworks at the end. Followed by the Stars and Stripes Forever. You know, these are evergreens that are always going to be part of a concert like that. This year, it's still in the process of working on this, but I'm working on a theme, particularly for the second half, of but I was about to say a salute to it. That phrase just gets used so much. A salute to this, a salute to that. But a look at the history of great American popular music, and going back maybe about a century, and you know, when you really look at it, American popular music is the world's popular music. We have exported this everywhere. The Beatles came in the '60s and kind of took over for a while, but then we got back. Got back at them. So there are a lot of great arrangements. I know we've done some of them in the past, but I really want to do something in the second half that sort of puts it all together and shows what a great country this is. Not just because we've won wars and we have a great military and a wonderful flag and everything else, but because we have a great culture too. Our culture, the history, the artistic history of this country, particularly musically, is second to nowhere else in the world. It was a hard won battle because up until about the 1950s or so, I think that, we were really looking to the Europeans as our elders. We wanted to be them when we grew up. Well, we've grown up now. And I think it's time that we can show off this musical heritage and do it in a way that I think everyone's going to really enjoy and appreciate.
Now, of course, March is Women's History Month. And in the new season...
Did everybody know that?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And in the new season, you are particularly highlighting that. So tell us a little more about what you plan for us and why.
Okay, and I'm going to do this by backpedaling expectations, or maybe by saying this maybe isn't really that big of a deal, because in the course of 6 classic concerts and 4 pops concerts, we just can't really do justice to this. And I'll tell you how this all got started is that while doing research, looking at pieces for the coming season, just going through different periods of history, looking for connections here and there, it kept occurring to me all the time, where are the women? You're looking back at the Beethoven's era, both Beethoven and Mozart, and Brahms. Where are the women composers? Well, there weren't any. Well, they were a couple. Clara Schumann was a composer. She wrote a piano concerto when she was 14. That's really remarkable. It's not very good. Mozart's piano concertos that he wrote when he was 14 weren't very good either. But she wasn't really allowed to be. She had to be Robert Schumann's husband, so she had to curtail that career. For the longest period of time, women weren't allowed to even be members of orchestras. Though there wasn't any prohibition against joining an orchestra, but you were just not allowed to learn the violin, to learn the cello, to learn the bass, to learn the trumpet, oboe, whatever. Women were keyboard players. You either sang or you played the keyboard, one of the two. And the men's work went to playing the orchestral instruments. So for even up until, I think it's been maybe 20 years, less than 20 years, that the Vienna Philharmonic finally admitted its first woman member. And I remember as a child going to Chicago Symphony concerts and seeing if not all people on the stage male, at least 98% of them. Usually the harpist, you find a female, the harpist was male back then too. This started to kind of percolate with me. Okay, where are the women? Where were the women? Now, when I was teaching music appreciation at Rockford University, we'd always have the latest contemporary textbooks. And of course, the textbooks now, they have to be all up to date and all politically correct in all ways, shapes, and forms. So they bent over backwards to put in important sections on women composers who I had never heard of before in my life. Because they wanted to show that there were women. Well, there was an occasional woman or two composing back then, But you know, this was not a career that women were encouraged to assume and were really allowed to pursue. So that got me to thinking, and it got me to thinking a little bit, well, what, you know, where are we now? Well, you look at almost any symphony orchestra in the world, particularly in this country, and it's roughly half women. Some of them are more female than there are male. And that's a great thing. That we got equality, we got parity now in employment in the orchestras. Composers, not quite so much so, although they're coming up. There's been an effort to nurture women composers. And I thought, all right, what would be really, really cool if we could have at least one piece on every program this year that was written by a woman composer. And we have fulfilled that, except for one. I cannot figure out who to put on the Mozart program in the fall. The Mozart program, which is the Mozart's last year. Three pieces Mozart wrote in the last year of his life. Certainly, I'm not going to find anybody from that era, but I'm still looking for the ideal piece to put into that. There may be still something there, but I may have to take a pass on that one. But more recently, there's been a recognition of, you know, where are the women conductors? Now, they're starting to, they're in the last probably 10 years, there's been many, many, many more women conductors starting to achieve prominence in this country. So at least once, I wanted to bring in a woman to conduct. I'd like to do it more than that, but I'm a little selfish. I mean, I like to conduct. I contacted actually my old conducting teacher, Bernie Rubenstein, who I studied with at Northwestern, who is now retired and living in Santa Fe, told me about a protege of his. Bernie has been doing a lot of work over the last couple of decades in Cuba, mentoring musicians in Cuba, and he has been mentoring a young Cuban conductor, Cosette Justo Valdez, who is a very, very talented woman. She studied in Germany and is now the assistant conductor of the Edmonton Symphony. And he put me in touch with her, and so we have arranged for her to conduct the, it says Classics 4, Classics 5 now, I forgot. It's the one in March, which is Women's Month anyway. And also in Women's Month, of course, it's the Women Rock. That's not too far of a stretch, because some of my favorite rock songs have been done by women musicians, and I've always been a big fan of Janis Joplin, and Joan Jett is another one, among others. But I apologize for not being able to do more in terms of highlighting women, showcasing women. I certainly don't want anybody to say, oh, congratulations, you did such a great job of bringing women musicians to our attention this year. That's not true. But you'll see a few more women composers than you've seen in the past. Libby Larson, by the way, is not a relative of mine. No nepotism there. She is a fellow Norwegian-American, but that's as far as that goes. So that's what's behind the Year of the Women.
Sounds terrific. Now let's turn to the soloists. Who are the soloists, at least some of them, that we can look forward to hearing this coming season?
Okay, Alexander Hirsch has a great story behind him. I don't know Alexander Hirsch. I've never met Alexander Hirsch. I've heard him play electronically, but Alexander Hirsch wrote me, remember a couple of years ago we did the Mozart Sinfonia Concertante with the cousins, the two cousins.
Ben Geller.
Yeah, the Gellers. So right after that, I got an email from Alexander Hirsch, who I'd never met, proposing that we program him and his father playing a father and son duet. It was the Brahms, the Brahms Double Concerto, which we'd also done with a father and son. like the year before, maybe even that year. And so I wrote back and I said, well, you're a little bit too late on this one, and we've already done that just this year. And Alexander wrote back and said, well, then may I propose that we conclude my grandfather, who's a concert pianist, and we do the Beethoven Triple Concerto. And I thought, you know, I like this guy. He's got good spot. He was in touch several times, and I did check out some of his materials. He's won some very impressive competitions. He's a very, very fine cellist, and is particularly in love with the Shostakovich First Cello Concerto, which is one of my favorite pieces too, which is a fantastic piece with a great horn solo. Kate didn't mention that. Kate's one, but there's a great, great horn solo in that piece too. So that's how Alexander came into being. Stefan Milenkovic is a Serbian violinist who was on the faculty at the University of Illinois. I did a concerto with him when I was conducting the Champaign-Urbana Symphony. Stefan, besides, he is probably the most low-key, high-octane violinist you'll ever run into in your life. He is an incredible player. And he, in a lot of ways, he'd much rather be doing things like hiking and mountain biking and things like that that take you outdoors. He's really an interesting character, but an incredible player, and a really, really nice guy, really interesting character. And I felt ever since I worked with him, I thought I really wanted to bring him to Rockford, and tried a couple times. We couldn't schedule it. Now we've got this scheduled. He is. I don't remember the exact title. He is the Grand High Puba of all musicians in Serbia or something. He's got some title like that.
Grand Puba, though,
that
doesn't sound
familiar. No, it doesn't sound quite right. So then we go to, Stefan. Oh, Darlene Carl Beck, who you saw on the... Darlene is our principal clarinetist. Has been for all the time I've been with the symphony. She is, as she mentioned, she's been playing this since eighth grade. The thing about Mozart concertos is that if you audition for an orchestra, everybody, when you audition for an orchestra, you are required to play the first movement of the concerto. Only a fool would play the first movement of a Mozart concerto. Because they are so hard. They get harder and harder and harder the better you get at them. Now, if you're a clarinetist or a bassoonist, you don't have a choice in the matter because that's pretty much all that there is for the instrument from that particular period. They're almost always required. But Mozart concertos bring out every bit of musicianship that you have. And they're beautiful to begin with. I mean, Mozart never wrote a bad note in his entire life. Talking about that concert in particular, these are three pieces that Mozart wrote in that wonderful shortened last year of his life, the Magic Flute Overture, the Clarinet Concerto, and of course the Requiem. The Requiem, which Weldon Anderson referred to in the movie Amadeus. Have you seen the movie Amadeus? Well, don't believe a word of it. It's a beautiful movie. It's beautifully filmed. Most of it's fiction. But it is true that there is, in a way, life is perhaps even better than fiction. The story is that Mozart, who was ailing and needing money rather badly, got a visit from a stranger who was dressed all in gray. And said, I'm representing somebody who is going to pay you very handsomely to write a requiem. And so he started writing the requiem, and he was visited again by that stranger, just checking how things were going. And Mozart died before he finished. And he his student Susemeyer finished in a fashion the piece enough so that Mozart could get paid, or at least his wife could get paid for writing the record. Now it turns out the guy who was commissioning the Stranger in Gray was a well-known at the time fraud who loved to commission composers to write pieces, and then he would perform them under his name. So its first performance was performed by this guy. I don't remember his name right offhand, but it was performed somewhere in some little Austrian town as written by this particular character. The Susemeyer version, as it's called, doesn't end very satisfactorily. Susemeyer was a very good copyist and a very diligent student. He was not Mozart. He was not anywhere close to Mozart. I've always been hesitant to do the piece because I just never felt that it ended well. A genius named Robert Levin came along who studied extensively the music of Mozart and researched Mozart's music, and came across some notations that had never been discovered before that added some music that Mozart had written, sketches that he had written that was intended to be included in the Requiem. And he included these in the Requiem in the right place and filled in a few blanks based on his knowledge of Mozart's style, and has come up with what I believe is a much more powerful and really much more musically satisfying version of the Requiem. Well, we did this piece about maybe 10 years ago. Marty, is that right?
15.
Oh, how time flies, 15. We did the Levin version back then, too. I don't regret it a bit. I said to myself, if I do it again, I will do the Levin version, and that's what we will be performing on this concert. Muza. Yes. Don't bother trying to pronounce her last name; you'll hurt yourself. It's Rubaskita, actually. Muza is the national musician of Lithuania. She is an astonishing pianist. I worked with her in Champagne. She did both of the Liszt concertos. The first rehearsal, the first concerto starts off with kind of an extended cadenza, not that extended, but cadenza for piano, which then leads into the orchestra. She played the cadenza and got to the end of the cadenza, and I was standing there with my mouth hanging open. Couldn't believe what I just heard. I've never heard it played that fast. She is incredible. She was actually supposed to be here a couple years ago, but she had a hand injury, suffered a hand injury, and had to put off her visit here. So we're finally getting her back now. She is one of the finest pianists you will ever hear in your life, and I'm really fortunate that. We're going to have her on this series playing a piece that doesn't get done that much anymore, which is really too bad because it's a barn burner of a concerto, the G minor piano concerto by Camille Saint-Saëns. A great piece. Look it up on YouTube, play it. It's just, wow. It's a fantastic piece. And then we get to the last concert, and the soloist is the orchestra, I guess. This last concert, again, we start with a piece by a woman composer, Anna Klein, called Masquerade. It's really a neat little piece. I really like it. And then we go to something completely different. And when I first talked about this with the staff, I said, we are going to do one of the most depressing pieces ever written. And they all looked at me like, huh? And I see it's written for 30 solo string players. And it's by Richard Strauss. It's one of the last pieces he wrote. And it's called Metamorphosen, or Metamorphoses. And he wrote this to express his complete desolation and grief at the at what he felt was the total destruction of German culture at the end of the Second World War. It's a devastating piece, and it ends with the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony. It's beautiful. I'm sure that you will love to hear it. It's again only 30 string players. Everybody has a solo part. But then, if you have a Don Grump all gone and jumped off of the State Street Bridge, I guess Jefferson Street is a little closer at that point. We go to the second half of the program. And this is another point of view, the point of view of the Soviet Union, who saw themselves as the big winner of the Second World War, despite the does anybody happen to know how many Soviet citizens died? It's a staggering number of deaths in that war. But this was the sort of the official, in a way, Soviet response to winning the Second World War by Sergei Prokofiev. And it's a symphony number 5, his last symphony. And it is it just carries you up, it just lifts you up. It's one of the great virtuoso pieces for orchestra. I'm sure it will bring everybody to their feet at the end.
I want to zero in on one other specific element of the season. In the fall, we'll be hearing a program entitled Last Night at the Proms. Knowing the mind I have, of course, the first thing that I thought about was the high school dances. And maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But what are the proms and what can we expect?
Let's see, you and I have a different take on this. My take was, well, what happened to the first night? The proms, in a way, are sort of they're the original Pops concerts, except they're not really Pops concerts. In England, this started back in the, I believe, in the 1930s. Sir Henry Woods established a series of concerts that there would be a concert one or two a week over, I think, as many as 70 different programs. And these concerts could be absolutely anything. They would be, the purpose was to familiarize more of the London population with good music and to provide this for them at a minimal cost. And then the last night of the proms was when this all came together. The original place of Queen Victoria Hall.
King Albert.
Hmm?
Royal Albert. No, it was before that. Anyway, that the original site was destroyed during the Second World War. And so it moved then to Royal Albert Hall, which is a huge auditorium. And this, over the period of years, achieved quite a life of its own. There's a lot of traditional English music, some traditional patriotic music, some lighthearted music, some things that only English understand. Like bobbing up and down and whistling and wearing funny hats. They call it the proms or the promenade concerts because of the promenade section, the with no seats. The center of the auditorium didn't have any seats, and so people could just come in there, fill in the space, and just stand. And the tradition came to wear silly costumes, often with a Britannia connection to them, and do silly things like make noises during certain pieces, and they will razz the conductor at certain points, sing Rule Britannia at the top of their lungs, all 10 verses of it, whatever. And of course, you know, what do you have to do? Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the waves, and Britons never, never, never shall be slaves. That's the chorus. Everybody just sings along with the chorus and has a great time doing this. Ending with Jerusalem, which has a significance over there that it doesn't have over here. But also the Elgar Pomp and Circumstance March, which somebody wrote words to and gave the land of hope and glory, and everybody sings lustily along to that with the chorus. Well, I thought, yeah, why should the English have all the fun? I put this out on the orchestra list, the conductors and composers listserv, and said, anybody have any experience in doing anything like this here? And well, some of the people in the Commonwealth have in Australia and Canada and everything, but nobody here. But everybody said, yeah, that's a great idea. We ought to have something that we all can get together and sing Sweet Caroline or something like that. And, all together and have fun and maybe do silly things. So we're going to do some silly things. We're going to have, besides some of the pieces we've mentioned, Joel Ross is going to be, what does Joel Ross do? He plays the piano. No, he's not going to play the piano here. He is going to play the pseudo French horn. There is an English group a few years back that came up with a comedy thing about using the rondo of the Mozart E-flat horn concerto called Ill Wind. And it's about a person who decides he has a hankering to play the French horn, and he buys a French horn and learns to play the French horn, but somebody steals his French horn. And it's all sung to the tune of this concerto, and Joel does an amazing job. This has not been written down in stone yet, but I talked to Bob DeVita last week about playing the musical Saw. Did you know that Bob DeVita plays the musical Saw?
Nope.
You won't believe it when you hear it. So I don't know. There'll be a few other things we'll have to have some alcohol fueled creativity sessions to come up with this. But I promise you that I want you to all practice singing Rule Britannia, Britannia Rule the Waves. So I don't think it's unpatriotic to do that. It's just lots of fun because you get to sing it as loud as you can. And of course, it's the Elgar Pomp and Circumstance March number 1. It's a great piece anyway, whether you sing along with it or not, and you can choose whether to sing along with it or not, but I encourage you to do so.
That sounds like a blast. That's more fun than a regular prom. Well, I don't know. It depends. We won't go any further there. Do I do questions and answers? Well, at least questions, hopefully, will be answers.
Yes, sir.
In the Frankenstein and Mozart concert, there's a Charles Rassman whom you did not mention.
No, and actually, this is one of my favorite pieces of the season. We've done this before. Charlie Rassman is, I met him, he played the role of Voltaire in Candide at Rockford University that I conducted last year. He's not a student there, he's a little older than that, beyond that, but a professional actor. He is now, his day job at least, is the manager of the Nordloff Center here in downtown Rockford. But I was really impressed with him as a performer, and I started thinking of him at that time as the chansonnier in Frankenstein. Now, I have to explain Frankenstein a little bit, but there is a version of it on YouTube that is in English. It's a little hard to find. H.K. Gruber is the conductor, is the composer. He's an Austrian, and it's Frankenstein with two exclamation points, and it's a he calls it a musical pandemonium, and it's a series of poems that are children's poems but they're just a little bit too dark to be children's poems. Originally written in German, but translated into English. And with all sorts of strange instruments in the orchestra, toy instruments and things that you don't expect to hear, it is so much fun to listen to, and I think he's going to do a great job doing it. I just remember the first. I should have looked up the first poem, but the first lines are little mouse, come into my mousy house. And you know, it gets a little darker after that. It won't frighten the children, but it's a lot of fun to listen to. And I think you're really going to enjoy that piece. I think that kind of wraps it up. Thank you, Phil.
Sure.
I appreciate your participation. And thank you all for coming tonight.